You are listening to the Gay Florida Man Podcast. This podcast is hosted by retired corrections officer Mark DeWolf, who will discuss various topics prevalent to corrections, gay culture, arts and entertainment, as well as current events. Listeners need to be advised that this podcast will discuss situations involving extreme violence, substance abuse, sexual assault, and murder. Details of actual events have been modified so as to protect the privacy of involved parties.
Welcome back to the Gay Florida Man. This is episode 5 of season 1. Tonight is going to be very exciting. We're going to talk to an actress who started at age 4 and made a career out of a business most people only dream of. Tonight, we're going to talk about her career and working as an associate producer on the Netflix series Murder Among the Mormons. I'm so happy to have on the podcast Miss JJ Neuwirth. Hello, JJ. How are you?
Oh, Mark, I'm great. So good to hear your voice.
It's been too long.
It's been a while. It's been a minute.
Tell me, you are like one of the few people that I run into that like is legit when you say that you're an actor or actress. Sorry. So many people that I run into, they say, oh, I'm a model or I'm an actress. And what they're saying is that they're in retail or they work as a waiter, waitress, and they're trying to get into it. But you're really into it. I mean, I was looking at your IMDb. You have 29 credits on IMDb, which is nothing compared to your actual professional resume.
Well, you know what? I it's good to know that there are 29 credits up there because I surely am not going in there and updating my IMDb. So somebody is.
Right.
I appreciate ya, whoever that is. but yeah, I've done a lot of work.
You broke into acting at age 4. And in your first role, you were a wave?
Yeah, in the church production of Noah's Ark. And so I was in a blue, probably a tutu or something, and waved my arms back and forth in front of a cardboard set that was made to look like a little boat.
Okay.
Yeah. And I remember I kept wiggling my fingers, and my the whoever was in charge of this says, okay, JJ, we need you to stop wiggling your fingers. And I said, no, it's spray. It's ocean spray.
Are you serious?
I'm totally serious. And I remember she said, well, there's no spray here. And wow. I think that's when I started doubting the existence of God. Because how could someone not know about spray? Hey, come on.
So JJ, okay. So when did you switch from being an actress to a comedian? Because I love that.
Couldn't even tell you. I think laughter was my refuge from being just a very, very awkward child.
Okay, if you had to put a ballpark guess on how many different parts you've had in film, television, industrial, commercials, all the different media outlets and stuff, what would you give your resume? Like, how many different things have you done?
Wow. I mean, we're talking about 2 decades of doing this full time. It's got to be 1,000, maybe. Wow. Right around there, of different kinds of projects. And that includes voiceover and industrial, the things that not everybody's going to see.
Right. Of course. But you, yeah, I mean, so many people aspire to breaking into the industry, and you've done it. I mean, you've done it, and you've been very successful. When I met you 20 years ago, there was definitely something about you that was different than the run-of-the-mill person that you run into on a set. I mean, you are definitely, you have that element. You had it. You had this magic. And it was really cool, and I was very privileged, and I'm still privileged to know you to this day.
Oh, well. Yes. Thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
What was the commercial that you and I worked on? Where was that? Like Holiday or something? But it was like, was it Saran Wrap or something? Remember, we were on a set together in a house. And I remember it was a great day because you and I laughed. At least I was laughing. was laughing. I hope you were too. But you're such an actress. I don't know. Well, I'll bullshit this guy and I'll just, you know, home in on my skills.
Right. We are sinister people that way. Although I honestly don't know many actors who enjoy acting outside of their work purview. So pretty much if you meet an actor, you can guarantee they're telling you the truth because they're just tired of acting. Okay. That commercial, it was a concept commercial.
Right.
The Saran wrap that could stick on anything, on paper, on plastic. It was not a released commercial. It was a concept video for internal.
For the company.
Right. Some sort of plastic wrap. And I really couldn't tell you whatever the product was specifically. Right.
Sure. Well, you know, I remember that I had a great time. That was a lot of fun. So long ago.
Yes. Well, it's pretty fun to be around you, Mark.
I appreciate that. You were in a part in a movie, Richard Dutcher, Evil Angel.
Yes, I was.
I don't know if you know this, but I actually have Ving Rhames' decapitated head
from the movie.
Yeah, I got it from Richard Dutcher. Yeah.
How on earth did you get? Well, there's not going to be a sequel. We know that much.
Right. So he had on his, I think it was his Facebook page, he had done kind of like a live auction, like highest bidder. And I was the highest bidder and I got Ving Rhames' head. Because the movie didn't get picked up and distributed, the bids didn't go that high. It was only like $600.
Oh my God. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was released overseas. I know that because a gentleman reached out to me and says, hey, I saw you in Evil Angel. Do you mind if I get your face tattooed on my thigh? And I said, of all the requests I've had in my life, that's got to be up there with some of the odd ones. But I said, sure, why not? I don't care if it's okay with Richard. And so he did.
Is it the movie poster? Is it like you on the movie poster that's what he tattooed?
It's when I'm in Lilith form, the demon Lilith. Right. And so my mouth is open. You see my mouth doing the scary face. That's what he wanted.
Wow.
And I said, knock yourself out. So I'm up there in some pretty good company. People's moms, Elvis, Jesus. And now I've been tattooed on somebody's person. So there you go.
Fantastic. Congratulations. That's
amazing. Thank you. So yeah, it was released overseas. I know that much.
That's very, very cool. That's very cool. So, you know, you've done a lot with your career. Congratulations. It's amazing. You're an excellent actress. Your resume definitely shows that you're capable of anything. So, but you've got a new project that you did last year. And you were heavily involved with a documentary that's currently on Netflix, Murder Among the Mormons.
Yes. And that one was released in 2021, but it was about 5 years in the making.
Wow. So, okay, how did you get involved with that? Tell me the story about your credit is associate producer. Tell me the story about how that came to be, because it's a great story if you have not seen it. On Netflix, people, definitely check it out. It's a great story about what happened in Utah many years ago with Mark Hoffman and his forgeries. It incorporates the Mormon Church. I love the documentary. I watched it twice. It's 3 episodes long. JJ, how did you get involved with that?
Well, I had been working with Tyler Meesom, who was one of the directors, for years. I think he was probably on his first crew production when I was in my first acting production on the same production, same movie. And we just kept in touch over the years and his career has just blossomed. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy. I just needed a change. I love acting. Mm-hmm. I also want to see it expand. I want to see parts with lots more voices. People think, oh, well, how many more voices can we get now? You know, we've got people of color are in films and TVs and they're fighting for more roles. And of course, because we've been really bad about including voices or not looking beyond what's written on the page and saying, well, okay, that says doctor, we have to have a white male as the doctor. So we still have to expand. A lot of that has changed. But when I first started in this business, something I absolutely had to do was market myself to my agent and go in and say, is there anything for me today? They would say, no, just this part for a reporter, just this part for a lawyer. And I would say, hold on a second. It doesn't say that they have to be male and or white. So how about, would you throw my hat in the ring? And that it took a while. And eventually they said, yeah, let's give it a shot. You write a character to write a character. That's what the writers do. Writing it for a race or a gender is something necessary. Mark, I am going off on a tangent. So I'll just edit that whole chunk out.
Sure. No, I get it. And the thing, JJ, Jeff Johnson would not see me unless the part was an FBI agent, cop, DEA, security guard, some type of government official. If it was not one of those parts, then I would be submitted for other things. But no, he didn't want to see me.
Right.
I get it.
The industry is expanding and we're getting more voices. Even so, 5 years ago, I was thinking, gosh, I am so tired. How many times can you do a commercial for a yeast infection or and feel that you are uninspired?
I've never done one.
Enough. I know. And I've never done one for prostate examinations, but I think we're limiting ourselves.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it's funny that you bring that up because I love the movie Tootsie.
Uh-huh.
You know, and remember, Dustin Hoffman was a very difficult actor and he wanted to read for everything. And I can be taller and I can be fatter and I can be shorter, whatever. And I love that, having had a taste of the industry, nothing compared to what you've had. But I love that portrayal. And I love that the people who wrote Tootsie definitely understand actors.
Right.
I loved it.
And I think actually that's important for actors to do. You don't just get an agent and then you sit back on your laurels. You have to keep working. I would go into my agents and dress differently, presenting differently, all that kind of stuff. And so I think that's very necessary. I also am going to say it is necessary. It has been necessary. I think it will continue to be necessary for especially white people to step back when someone asks them to do something that would be more appropriate for a person of color to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll use as an example, I've had voiceovers where someone would say, okay, would you do that again? But would you kind of sound more black?
And
really? I'm like, what do you mean by that? You mean talk like this? Or what are you talking about? And they want something more urban or something more southern or something. We use so much racial shorthand while I understood what they were saying, I said, I don't know what you mean. I'm not going to do that. There are so many actors of color who can do that part. Why on earth would you hire me?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, especially on voiceovers. And so, I mean, that's one example. And when I said we've got to step back too, it's a push and pull. There's the promotion, and then there's also looking to your left and your right and seeing who else needs us to be playing nice.
Let me ask you this, JJ. Do you think that issue with somebody being so wildly inappropriate to say the stuff like that, like can you sound more this particular ethnicity? Do you think that is more common in a community like Utah, where Utah doesn't have the diversity, say like LA or New York?
That's a good question. Perhaps when this happened, which was probably about 15 years ago, that is true, would have been true. But I am kind of the opinion now where there's no excuse with the internet, with information, the way it is. There's really no excuse for people to continue perpetuating this downward spiral.
Right, right.
It's like, come on. If you're in the business, you've got to know this stuff.
Baseline. As you talk about, like, I mean, I grew up in Virginia about 45 minutes away from DC. And, you know, my neighborhood had just like everything. We had Taiwanese, we had, you know, African-American, we had Jewish people, we had Protestants, Episcopal, everything. It didn't matter. You didn't look at these things. I go out to Utah. It didn't seem like everybody was, except, of course, there's a huge Polynesian community in Utah. Other ethnicities maybe aren't as represented. And it wasn't until I came to Florida where I really see things that kind of raise an eyebrow and go, God, that comes across really as racist. Like, it was kind of shocking moving here. And I didn't move here until I was 45. And I see things that kind of, you know, raise an eyebrow and go, like, wait a minute, are those people for real?
You're seeing that where you are as opposed to being in Utah. Is that what I understood?
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, it's, you know, when you move into the deep South, it's a different world. And I mean, in the town that I live in, it's actually a little more mainstream. It's a college town. It's pretty good. Yet in this town, inside a county that seems to be not so accepting, we'll just say that.
I think Utah has been benefiting from its own awkwardness in that it is so white that it's there haven't been cultural conflicts the way that there have been in other parts of the nation, racial conflicts, because everybody's been white.
Right.
And it's very easy for a lot of Utahns to say, oh yeah, I have no issue with people of color. And it's like, well, good. And yet I don't think that you've actually been challenged on that, because there are no people of color, or the ones who are here. Oh gosh, this is all sounding like an us and them, a real they, but if a person of color is here, Utah is a refugee state. A lot of people don't know this. And it's the one really great thing about Utah is that our governors have taken very seriously the obligation of creating a refugee state. So we have had a lot of refugees from the Middle East, from Syria, from African countries, I think specifically Somalia, some Congolese. We do, but of course they're not in the industry. They're still learning English and recovering from the trauma of being in a refugee state, or right, in a place where they needed refuge. So, I mean, long story short, I don't know how much of this you want to include in your podcast, but long story short, I think Utah has been benefiting from its own blindness.
Right.
You know?
Right. You started talking about going to your agent and really kind of like being able to get access to more variety of different parts and being able to read for other things than, you said, you use the example reporter. How does it lead into associate producer for Murder Among the Mormons?
The older I got, first of all, it is still true that parts disappear for older women and you've got to fight for them. But I just really started thinking about where I wanted to put my hustle. I realized that the system wasn't going to change unless I was part of the change. Mm-hmm. Now, I would then reach out to Tyler Meesom, who was one of the directors on Murder Among the Mormons. And since we'd been friends, work acquaintances for such a long time, I said, hey, what you working on? What you need? I need a new perspective. He was finishing up a documentary called I Want My MTV, which I assisted on. It's a fun one, by the way, about the advent of MTV and how it came to be. It's on A&E. And Tyler says, you know, I just might have something. And he had finished reading a book that was inspiring him to do the Mark Hoffman story. Away we went. That was what I helped on I Want on TV. And then we started doing research on Murder Among the Mormons. And wow, what a story. what an adventure that was.
And I love what you guys have done with Murder Among the Mormons. I love the characters. And I think that's one of the reasons that Tiger King did so well, is because of all the characters, these over the top characters. And they weren't as extreme as in Murder Among the Mormons, but I still absolutely love the people that you guys interviewed and the perspectives that you got.
They were amazing people, all of them. to this day, I feel protective of the subjects. And at the same time, I'm like, ooh, I could tell you some stories that didn't make it into the movie. But all of them extraordinary in their own lives, as it were, the stories that they had.
I know that, like, the whole, like, historical documents relating to the Mormon Church is big business in Utah.
Anything
about the history of the Mormon Church, people eat that up. And unless you live there or you're LDS and you have relatives there or whatever, it's big time. My personal favorite character in the whole movie was Shannon Flynn.
Yeah. What a character.
Oh, my God. I couldn't get enough of him.
Oh, man. Now, here's a fun fact.
Okay.
In the recreations that were primarily directed by Jared Hess, who you may know as the director of Napoleon Dynamite.
Right.
So that was always an interesting combination, Tyler Meesom and Jared Hess. But the gentleman who plays Shannon Flynn in those recreations is my husband.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it was one of those things where the Tyler and Jared kind of decided this behind my back, but then they said, hey, do you think John would mind playing Shannon Flynn? And he did have to audition. He auditioned against a bunch of other folks. Hey, that's nepotism for you. I thought he did a wonderful job. A wonderful job. But that's how some doors get opened, I suppose.
Absolutely. I'm going to go back and watch it for a third time. I'm going to have to watch it. Yeah. That's, when the film's done, what was your favorite part of the documentary? Was there a favorite scene for the revelation with Mark and his car and the bomb going off, and they think that maybe he's a target, but once they connect the dots and they realize that, you know, he's the one that's creating these bombs. What was your favorite part of the three-part series?
This is...
Besides seeing your husband.
Well, yes.
Okay.
but this is a behind-the-scenes moment, and it's one of the things that makes me very proud of the work I did on Murder Among the Mormons. We had already started shooting. This is during COVID. We had heard rumors that there was a whole bunch more material out there, but we could not find it. We had been looking for a couple of years and couldn't find it. A long, boring story of how I did this, but I played detective, wound up finding this huge stockpile of materials, including the answering machine tape that you hear at the end of the third episode where people are calling into Steve Christensen's office.
Okay. Yep.
Hey, buddy, are you okay? I heard something happened downtown. All of that was found at the last minute by me. And I think that scene and how Jared and Tyler pulled it together, it's just so chilling.
Right.
And it brings back idea. It's very easy for us to put people into categories of characters, but this was a real person. Steve Christensen was a real man, a gem of a guy. Mm-hmm. And he was murdered brutally by someone who, in my opinion, wasn't just trying to cover up his tracks, but he was insanely jealous of Steve Christensen, probably the only guy as smart as Mark Hoffman.
Right.
And Mark, the bomb that he used to kill Steve Christensen was designed differently. It had a lot of nails, carpenter nails taped to the outside, which is, you know, you're in law enforcement, you know, that's designed to shred and destroy. Yeah. That's personal.
Yep.
Whereas the one that murdered Gretchen Sheets, intended for Gary Sheets, did not have those nails on it.
Right.
But you asked about my favorite scene, and I would say it's probably when we have the actor walking down the hall and you can hear the recordings of people calling in to see if Steve Christensen's okay.
Yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah.
Steve Christensen is buying the documents from Mark Hoffman and then donating to the Mormon Church.
Yes, more or less, yes.
It seems like in the documentary there was kind of speculation that the Mormon Church was buying the documents, but then you've got Gordon Hinckley saying, no, we're not paying for these.
Oh, he absolutely was buying them.
Okay. And so I was wondering,
yeah, there's no question.
if Steve Christensen is just brokering the deal.
It's both things were happening.
Okay.
I understand that the Mormon Church had to mitigate the damages. Of course, they'd want to do that, but they were certainly involved in actively finding these kinds of documents. Didn't really ask too many questions. I think that's safe to say.
I think it's safe to say
that there is evidence that the Mormon Church, Hinckley in particular, did know that there were some shady things going on.
Right.
But they wanted the documents.
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I just, you know, as I really kind of understood, because I did not follow this story, I'm sure that I ran into Mark Hoffman at some point, you know, in my 20 years at the prison, I'm sure at some point he was there. I did count and I, you know, saw him in his underwear asleep or whatever at midnight and didn't even know who it was. It's just another body to me. But when I saw the film, this series, this documentary series, and I really started to understand the forgeries and what was at stake with the Salamander letter and the McClellan collection and what that could do to the bedrock of the Mormon Church and what they've taught all these years and how that could threaten the hierarchy of the Mormon Church. This is what we've told our membership for this long. I could see where they would be very threatened.
Yeah, and it's really no different than other religions, the Catholic Church hiding information about Dead Sea Scrolls, or just pick one, and there is going to be some sort of event where human beings have decided what's best for other human beings, for other human beings to know. I suppose one of the things that was most important to me to realize during the process of filming is, again, that while we want to pigeonhole and put these folks into characterizations, because that's easy for us to understand, they weren't dumb people. These weren't I know that you didn't say that, but that I always feel the need to say that these were not some dumb hicks. They were people who truly had a faith-based journey, wanted things to go well for their religion, as I think we all do. For whatever it is we believe, because of that, got caught up. They didn't do their due diligence. It's Bernie Madoff did exactly the same thing, starting off in going to synagogues and creating this level of trust and elitism and all these things that we as human beings are drawn to. And then you realize how easy it is to lose your footing.
Right.
And art forgeries, holy crap, Mark. I don't know if you have ever done any reading on art forgeries. It is unbelievable how many reputable art companies, dealers, auction houses are aware that things that they are selling are frauds. It's unbelievable.
Right.
But people don't want to know that.
No.
They'd rather believe that their baseball was signed by Babe Ruth.
Well, you know, in the whole world of like art collecting in the version of props and wardrobe, which is kind of like my thing. That's what my hobby is. And that's what I follow. You know, you'll get things that pop up online and the other collectors jump in and they start critiquing and they start taking film and, you know, behind the scenes photos and different clips, whatever they can get their hands on to look at a particular prop and start to dissect it and say that was not used on screen. For a long time, your prop dealers, your Prop Store of London or Screen Used or these other sites, they would say it's authentic, it's real, it was used in the screen. But now they've kind of gone to a generalization of made for production or used in production. We're not saying that this prop right here is the one that you see on the screen. We're saying that it was made by the production people for use in this film. That's what we're saying. And I'm sure it's to cover themselves legally so that people can't come back and say, you sold this to me and you said this was screen used. Well, it was screen used, but it ended up on the editing room floor.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of something being authentic is a fascinating one that can absolutely be broken down. You know, this is an authentic baseball that Babe Ruth played with. Okay. you mean people were walking around and tracking what baseballs Babe Ruth touched?
Right.
Really?
Right.
I think they're more inclined to do that now than back in the 40s.
Now that they realize the value of this stuff, then all of a sudden it's like they start to track that, and the prop master starts to become very, very secretive or protective of a prop that he knows he's going to be able to sell in 5 years for $100,000.
Yeah. Yeah. And on a large scale too, what is the truth? Mark Hoffman said, if I make it and you believe it, that's the truth. And it's kind of like, whoa, that's turning my head upside down. I mean, not in the way that I can't understand, but in the way that, especially in this last half decade, we have seen people say, I'm going to invent the truth. Fuck you.
Right, you know what I mean? Right. No, absolutely. When this whole thing happened, when the whole, this whole thing broke, was it 1985?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's when the bombs were set off.
Right. Do you remember the original story? Do you remember when this happened? At that time, I would have been in Virginia.
I wasn't living in Utah at the time. I think I was in Southern California. And I do recall vaguely hearing something about these bombs that had gone off and not thinking much of it at the time. I couldn't even tell you how old I was. Probably because I can't math that high. But that's some advanced math. But yeah, I had heard of it. It didn't mean much to me, even though in Southern California there is a large group, lots of Mormons in Southern California, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I believe you me, going down that path with Eight the Mormon Proposition. You know, they definitely funneled a lot of money to California.
Oh, yes. Yes, I see what you're saying. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And they should lose their tax exempt status because of it.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Because they were acting as a political action group rather than a church.
And using 501c3 religious materials, time, energy to enact a political campaign.
What they were using was their means and their ways. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Did you see that documentary, JJ?
Oh, no, I did not.
Eight, the Mormon Proposition. I saw it at Sundance. And I saw it at the Tower Theater. My mind was blown. It's a great documentary, since we're talking about documentaries. But if you have not seen it, anybody that's listening.
I have seen that. Yes, I have. That was okay. 2010, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes, I have seen that. Sorry that I forgot it. But
No worries. I just.
No, I'm apologizing to them.
Oh, right.
I watch a lot of stuff, guys.
You are on it. I love it. It's great. Is there going to be more episodes, possibly? To this series?
It is so, you know, the business. It is hard to tell what is going to strike people's fancy. Right now, there's nothing planned, but there have been conversations, because the story doesn't stop when the movie stopped, when the series stopped. It goes on, and there are some fascinating things going on, or that did go on. Not the least of which, talking about what we were saying earlier, is the idea that there is now a market for Mark Hoffman forgeries. So there is detective of sorts that we interviewed. She did not wind up in the documentary, but she is literally trying to track down all of the Hoffman forgeries, which he was supposed to reveal as part of his plea deal. And somehow that didn't happen. But we know that there are more Hoffman forgeries out there.
I talked to Warren Jeffs, you know,
get out of here.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He was in a building I worked in, and I remember he was on the second tier, and there was a TV in the section. He was in a lockdown unit. And so he was only allowed out for rec and had to be escorted, shackled, and handcuffed to the shower, but he was in his cell on the second tier and they were watching Cops on the section TV. And that particular episode of Cops that night was Las Vegas, where he was busted. And I remember talking to him at a cell door, and I said, you know, they always catch the worst guys in Vegas. He started laughing, and I laughed. And he probably went over and knelt down and prayed that I die, but I don't know.
No, he probably said, this guy, I just need to work on this guy right here. Well, he's so nice.
He's sort of send an evil angel to give him Ving Rhames' head or something.
Yes. There you go.
He was very, very soft-spoken. He did want to know my first name, and I told him my first name was Mark, but we don't use first names.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. You know, he wasn't a problem as far as when I dealt with him. Yeah.
Mark Hoffman? Yeah, no, I understand he keeps his head down. And I also understood, or maybe you're talking about Warren Jeffs now.
Warren Jeffs was my story. Mark Hoffman, I don't remember ever having an interaction with him. I don't know. The one high profile case of that guy that killed his wife and he was in medical school. He went out and bought a new mattress at RC Willie. He was high profile, went on the news saying, please help me find my wife. And he was supposedly in medical school.
That guy.
And then he
later killed his children and it like blew up the house or something. That guy?
That's a different guy. The guy that I'm talking about, his wife was under the impression he was in medical school and he was not. And when she found out, she wanted a divorce. So he shot her while he was sleeping. And then he went on the news because they couldn't find her. And then they realized that he had just bought a new mattress at RC Willie and had dumped the other mattress because of her blood and everything. But
this is sounding familiar.
And he, of course, he went to, he came to prison. From what I understand, he got a tattoo of a bulldozer, and that represents the bulldozer that would have gone over his wife's body in the dump.
Oh, wow. So, That's ugly. Jeez.
Yeah. Not a nice guy. He's right where he needs to be.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
You know, JJ, there's so many stories, 20 years, you just meet all these guys and it's.
Well, and now I don't know if it's the same thing in Florida, but now a lot of people around here are talking about the Under the Banner of Heaven book. And that's now a movie with Andrew Garfield. I haven't seen it yet, but that was about the Ron and Dan Lafferty brothers.
Okay. We chatted on this on Messenger the other day.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I have not seen it.
Mormons murdering people is still a hot ticket. there's such an interesting relationship with a lot of non-Mormon America and Mormon America. And the non-Mormon America is still kind of, well, they're skeptical of each other, I suppose. And so the marketing departments down there on Main Street is working very hard to make Mormons present as very kind, loving, wonderful people, which acts in opposition to all of the gory details we want to know about all these Mormons who have committed crimes. And it's like, good Lord. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. When I came here to Florida 5 years ago, people here, when you say Mormons, they give you that blank stare because they don't know what you're talking about. What's a Mormon?
Mitt Romney?
No, like, they don't. They don't.
They don't put two and two together?
No. This is Floridians. So let's just end it right there. Okay. It's, you know.
Oh, it's, wow. Okay.
So but they
your
do,
podcast.
They do love Trump down here. They love Trump. Yeah, this is Trump country. Not my town, but the county this is Trump County for sure.
Something that I found very interesting working on Murder Among the Mormons was to become acquaintances with Dory, Mark's ex-wife.
Okay.
And she is a staunch Trump supporter. She is also deeply hurt by everything that happened. There's no question she was one of the victims of Mark's actions. I mean, her kids suffered. She suffered. They didn't have anywhere to turn. No income. That was rough over nothing that they did. I really believe that Dory didn't know. If she suspected, she did that kind of good and faithful wife thing and just put it out of her mind, which is a fantastic talent that quite a lot of women have, quite a lot of partners have when dealing with a sociopath. There is something interesting finding out that she was a staunch Trump supporter. And
how did that come? How does that come up in conversation?
Well, you're spending a lot of time with these subjects. I don't think this is any sort of betrayal of trust. She's pretty open about her beliefs, and it's just that was during the end of Trump's reign, elections were going to be coming up. People were talking about elections kind of carefully on the DL, but at the same time, everybody had an opinion. I cannot tell you if it was actually something she said or if it was just one of those, because of the chemtrails that are indicating where the Pizzagate Democrat senators are kidnapping Mongolese microchips for Bill Gates. I mean, it was just one of those things where you just go, wait, what did you just say?
Right.
What did you just say? But I think there's something interesting about the fact that she was married to a liar and deceiver and then would later support a liar and deceiver again.
It's interesting. I guess she divorced him like what, 2 years later?
Yeah. She was out of there.
Yeah, she divorced him. Correct me if I'm wrong, JJ, but like a lot of the reason that he got into this situation with selling these documents, these forgeries, is because of his lavish lifestyle. I mean, he was like addicted to money and that high profile, but with the whole McClellan collection, like I guess he was getting behind in his debt. Am I understanding that right from what I've remember from the documentary? Is he was, how does Dory not see? I mean, I don't know if she's just a housewife that like, well, Mark takes care of the bills, I don't get involved with that. I guess it's hard to fathom that in 2022.
I hear you. And when I started on this, I thought there's no way she couldn't know. I think especially if you understand the culture and the culture at that time in particular, where the gender roles were so incredibly divided. Dory had a lot on her plate. She was raising children and often didn't have money. And the second that she got money, she was going to she had to rush to the bank, cash it, go buy groceries. I think even if there was some suspicion that what he was doing wasn't on the up and up, although I have to say, honestly, she never indicated that, and I believe her. Even if she suspected that, if you're a mother with your children and you are trying to make things work, maybe you don't always question where the money's coming from.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. That does make sense.
You know, I mean, not everybody's, if somebody works at a bank, they're not investigating all of the transactions and, well, is this coming from some terrorist nation? You do your work and you cash your paycheck and you go on with your life.
How many kids did Mark have?
Three.
With her? And so did they not want to be involved with the documentary?
Very much not. They've changed their names. They want nothing to do with it. I have to correct something. Mark had four children total. The three were with him at that time, at the time of the bombings, and the fourth was born after he went to prison.
She was pregnant.
Yeah.
Not saying that I'm going to go out and forge documents and sell them for high profile money, but that's got to be a lot of stress, even at that time period, to be having four kids. I can't imagine that.
And Mark's you've got to gone start... and always secretive. Dory's doing her best to be a good wife and a good mother. And so in the community at that time, and maybe continuing, I can't speak to that, but it was very much a, shush, you do your mothering, you do your wifing, and you leave everything else up to your husband.
And a lot of that is part of that culture, like you're saying that.
Yeah.
You raise the kids, you take care of the house. Not that I agree with any of that, but
agree with it or not, it's a thing, and it's you know, ultra Orthodox Jews, conservative Catholics, it's all over the place where these gender roles must be upheld in order for the marriage to survive. And of course, that's at that insane. Time, she was working very hard to keep her marriage. She had a temple marriage. It was a huge deal to her. So as far as whether or not she knew, I think perhaps in hindsight, she could go back and say, okay. Yeah, maybe I should have been more aware. But red flags are awfully easy to see up close.
Right. Well, when you see this whole story, and as everything, all the details are coming out, this movie is coming together, this documentary, three-part series on Netflix.
Yeah, documentary, docuseries.
What was the most shocking detail that you found out that you didn't know prior to going into filming?
Oh my God. I'm not sure I could just pinpoint one shocking thing, because you can't make this stuff up. This story
was great.
It was great. One-armed man is chasing Mark Hoffman, trying to get his money back, which is making Mark Hoffman panic and go out to the desert and blow up. I mean, it was just like, what?
Right.
You did what now?
This is a documentary or some new sitcom. I mean, it's just insane. It's SNL sketch.
It just kind of blows your mind. Because we all think of ourselves as relatively stable, relatively integrous people, right? I mean, maybe if we found $20 on the street, we wouldn't all run to try and figure out who it belongs to. We'd probably pocket it. So there's a little bit of a gray area for all of us. It's just you find out these stories in Mark's life and you just kind of cringe. And you think, oh God, don't do that. Oh geez, no, don't do that. Like, do you recall the movie Fargo?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yes.
And how it just, William H. Macy's character just spirals. And it's like, okay, no, pump the brakes. If you step out now, you can at least redeem something. And he just can't do it. And that's kind of what this documentary felt like, without the sympathy for Mark.
Right. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I can absolutely respect the fact that he had a talent for forgery and for chemistry.
Well, with the paper and being able to date he knew to get books from that time period.
But agree with Jerry D'Elia, who was one of the prosecuting attorneys for a time. Mark wasn't a genius. It's just that we weren't looking for it.
Right.
If you're looking for it, then it kind of falls into place. And of course, a very proud moment is that the FBI and the University of California and the Library of Congress are all saying these documents are real. And there's this one little check forging investigator from Utah who says, I don't think it is. And he figures it out.
That's nuts. You
Isn't
know,
that amazing? And that was George Throckmorton, which is incredible. I just think I love that story.
Well, to refer back to what you said earlier with like fake artwork, fake forgeries, and all these things, people want to believe. And in that culture with the Mormons and the history, they want to believe. People want to believe that this is true.
In so many things.
Yeah.
Blind faith is one of the most dangerous things we can have.
Amen.
If we don't have the capability to be critical thinkers, we might as well just start counting the end of days.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, that's what's going to happen. And that sounds very dramatic, but it's absolutely the truth. If we don't question things, we have no place to go but down.
You have been listening to The Gay Florida Man. My guest tonight has been J.J. Neuward. J.J., thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, it was my pleasure. 100%.
I hope you'll come back and visit us again and we can exchange more of our crazy stories.
Would love that. And I'm sure we'll have more crazy stories by then.
Awesome. Remember what I always say, people, and that's be good. And if you can't be good at it. And if you're sitting in a prison cell, you're not good at it. This has been the Gay Florida Man. Everybody have a wonderful night.
Good night, everyone.